You are all weirdos.
Weird science is the revolution. Weird science is the revolution.
Welcome all you weirdos, seeds that maybe aren't so good, and everyone currently flashing mutant gang signs. It is time for your X-Men 97th Weird Dose of X, the mutant member of your Weird Science podcast family. I am your mysteriously magnetism-powered host, Jason, broadcasting, as always, from the Wrong Turn Studio, perched high atop stately Weird Science Tower. And joining me today is a magical organism designed only for podcasting, my pal Ruben. Hey, Ruben, how the heck are you today?
Hey, pretty good. I'm trying to decide, should I feel insulted about the MODOK comparison?
I went with magical. I wasn't sure what to go with that first adjective up front. I thought magical would be all right, so I hope you're okay with that.
Yes.
Well, we have a lot to talk about today, and some of it kind of decent. It is a double Jerry Duggan day, which, you know, there's some risk involved with that, but we'll see if we can find some good things. We're going to talk about Wolverine number 48 from last week that we kind of punted ahead a week. And then we're going to do Iron Man number 18 and X-Men number 34, kind of the final issue of that series, depending on how you want to count the whole issue 700 coming up in a little bit over a month. But before that, there was a certain holiday that occurred just this past weekend. Did you celebrate Free Comic Book Day at all there, Ruben?
No, that would have required me to go out and buy physical comics. And I'm extremely...
in the actual real world.
Yeah. I guess not buy, right? But go procure physical comics. I really don't like the clutter of comics. I have a collector problem. I have a bin of comics from the 90s when I did collect physical comics, and they just occupy space. I never read them, and I also can't part with them. And so I do not want to increase that problem by getting more physical stuff.
I'm fairly similar, except I don't even have a whole bunch of old physical comics. I kind of started reading comics in digital form, and I love just being able to sit in my couch and have my tablet. I can either buy whatever comic I want or go to the various, you know, all-you-can-eat kind of sites, the manga or the Marvel Unlimited. I like it that way, but I figured it is Free Comic Book Day. I do want to get the this new X-Men story that looks forward ahead, so I stopped into a comic shop. The only one around me is a Newbury Comics, so it is a, you know, a corporate chain. It's not quite the, you know, independent hole in the wall kind of a place. They didn't even seem to have any like used dollar bin, not even used, like dollar bin kind of comics. I would have loved to browse through that and see what I could find, but I did pick up a couple of the Free Comic Book Day issues, and I bought some stuff too. It seemed I don't know. I don't know what the etiquette is, but I know our old pal Chris always complained about people who only go on Free Comic Book Day and forget their wallets at home. So I don't want to be that guy. I picked up a facsimile edition of Crisis on Infinite Earths, number one. That was cool. I got a variant cover of one of the recent Iron Man books. It had a Dracula homage cover on it, so that was kind of neat. And I got a volume of manga. I got the first volume of Monster, which is a book I've been meaning to get to. So that was fun, and I got these Free Comic Book Day things. So yeah, I get where you're coming from, but it's a nice idea to kind of get out there once in a while, and it is a different experience looking at physical comics. I know it seems dumb to say that. All you people out there are going stupid, we know that. But as someone who's read well over 99.9% of all the comics I've ever read in digital form, it's a different experience. I mean, the spread pages especially, the pages are still bigger than my tablet. I do think maybe the comic I got is malfunctioning because I keep trying to pinch to zoom in and it's just not working. So I'm wondering if I need to put this on like a charging pad first or how that works, but maybe that's just a technical issue. But it is it was a fun time, and maybe I'll do that more often.
I don't need people to know how many thousands of dollars I've spent on cartoons and scribbles.
It is. Well, I mean, it does keep... When I think about all the time I spend looking at this stuff, I don't mind spending a little bit of money for all these hours of entertainment I get. But let's talk about the actual story here. Have you heard anything at all about...
you're going to be my lifeline. Yeah, I was looking online to see if I could get a copy on Comixology, and I probably can, but it seemed like more effort than it was worth. Unless you tell me these are amazing stories, in which case I'll put in that effort.
There's some intriguing stuff. Let me tell you about it. So the Uncanny X-Men Free Comic Book Day story is the second half of the Blood Hunt issue. So you're looking for the one with all the, you know, vampire-y stuff on the cover. And it is written by Gail Simone with art by David Marquez, who are the creative team for the Uncanny book. And we do start at a particular location. I'm going to make you guess, Ruben. Where do we think the opening scene of Uncanny Free Comic Book Day story is?
The Westchester Mansion.
How did you know?
X-Men.
Yes, it is at the mansion. But it's not acting like the X-Mansion. It is very much telling us that we're not going to be at the X-Mansion the way it usually is. It's under military guard. Workers are building a wall around it. And as I'm looking, the wall just got 10 feet higher. Jubilee is sulking around outside the wall until a guard tells her, "Hey, lady, get out of here." And then she has a little adventure at a diner, which this part is very much traditional X-Men as outsider metaphor for whatever you want to be a metaphor. There's a mutant kid who works in the diner who looks kind of like a zebra, got some stripe thing going on. There's a bit where Jubilee flashes this kind of gang sign at her. It's like the I love you sign, but with the arm upside down, so it looks like an M. So she flashes that gang sign at this kid, Uva. Uva kind of hesitates, but sends it back. And then Jubilee, you know, beats up some bigots and sets their car on fire. You know, the usual kind of thing. It does seem like her firework powers are upgraded to some extent. Don't know how, don't know why, but there is reports. Like one other character says, oh, looks like she's got an upgrade. The more interesting bit to me is when we get to see what's going on inside the mansion. Now, what we see that it's being run by a woman named Dr. Corina Ellis, who's a new character. And it's kind of like an Arkham Asylum for dangerous mutants kind of place, is the feeling I get. Dr. Ellis is being assisted by a frail, bald mutant named Philip, who used to be an inmate in this place. I don't know how, because it seemed to be just under construction, but it says he used to be an inmate, maybe at a different location. And he used to have the mutant name of Scurvy. Also, as far as I can tell, very much a new character. He has like a telepathic mutant sensing power, maybe similar to Caliban. And we get some glimpses of a few of the other inmates. There's a big guy who might be the Blob. And there's someone else who is definitely Teresa Cassidy, Banshee's daughter, a.k.a. Siren. Now, we haven't seen her for a while. Any memory of this character, Ruben? You have an experience with Teresa Cassidy? She's been called Banshee in the past at one point, I guess when her dad was, you know, dead. But she's been Siren, and she's wearing a name tag, so we can be pretty sure it really is her. And she's also wearing like a straitjacket muzzle combination. Don't know exactly what she might have done. And there's also no sign of that power damping tech that was so common early in the Krakoan era, just physical restraints. There's another prisoner, one we don't get to see, who is sealed behind a round door that looks like it's a supersized bank vault kind of door, just huge, tons and tons and tons. Don't get a name. It's just labeled Inmate X. So obviously this either is Professor X or we're being set up to think of this Professor X for there to be a switcheroo down the road. And Dr. Ellis says to this prisoner, hey, get comfortable in there because you're never leaving that room again. And that's where we are. Now, the outside world situation, very much a been there, done that kind of a thing. But the situation of the mansion seems promising, although I don't know which title is even going to be telling this story. Maybe we can assume it's going to be the Gail Simone Uncanny one, because that's who's writing this, but maybe it's just going to pop in and out of all the various titles. So that's what we've been given to think about from the Free Comic Book Day sneak preview. So Ruben, does that get you at all excited about this upcoming From the Ashes era?
I wish it did, but it actually makes me a little apprehensive because it makes me think of the post-M-Day era where the mansion was kind of under heavy government supervision.
Was that when there was always a sentinel kind of hanging around in the background? Is that
period? Yeah, okay. Yeah. So hopefully, I mean, Gail Simone's a clever person, right? And she has a lot of experience with these kind of storylines. So I would expect her to know that's already happened and for her to do something different. Mm-hmm. But it does feel a little like been there, done that, just at a first blush.
Well, it's only a few more weeks until this starts happening for real, so I am curious. I hope there's some sort of a switcheroo going on with the Prisoner X, because otherwise it just seems so clear that it's Professor X that it would be, why bother not telling us his name if it's this obvious? If it's this obvious, it should be somebody else, but who knows? And I'm curious why Siren ended up, as this key prisoner as well. But that's for future us to worry about. Current us is going to talk about this week's books and also one of last week's books that we didn't have time for. So let's get right to Wolverine number 48, Sabretooth War Part 8, Alone Together, which is the antepenultimate issue of this arc and of this volume of Wolverine. Written by Benjamin Percy and Victor Laval. Pencils by Corey Smith. Inks by Oren Jr. Colors by Alex Sinclair. Letters by Corey Pettit. And as always, we get an editorial reminder that this whole Sabretooth War story takes place before Fall of the House of X number 1. And I'm going to take a second here to talk about the cover, which we do once in a while. It's by, I'm going to go Lionel Francis Yu. I'm not quite sure how to say that gentleman's first name. And Romulo Fajardo Jr. It looks really cool. It shows Logan being stretched in four dimensions by all four of his limbs by four different saber-tooth hands. It doesn't directly refer to anything particular in this issue, but it's a cool image. And so, Ruben, I'm going to ask you, are you old enough to remember who Stretch Armstrong was? Yes. Is that a name that rings any bells?
Yeah, that toy was in the stores when I was a kid. But
okay, that's good. I'm not that much older than you then. Because this is certainly a riff on Stretch Armstrong, which for you youngsters out there was like a boy's action figure type toy. It was probably like a 10 to 12 inch figure. And it was super stretchy. It had some sort of a gel inside. You could stretch his limbs all in weird ways and tie him in knots. It was a thing. And that's definitely what's happening to Wolverine here. Now, as the actual issue kicks off, both Wolverine and Sabretooth are off the board. Logan, because he's been depowered and badly injured. And Victor, because he's been trapped inside the giant Venus flytrap-looking thing that came out of Doug Ramsey's poorly named killing seed. It's too bad that old Doug didn't leave any better instructions for how the seed works, isn't it? Oh, well. after carrying the seed around for several miniseries, Necra finally used the thing to trap Creed, but then didn't bother to stick around to bring him into custody or finish him off. Just kind of said, you know, dusted her hands off and said, okay, that job's done, and left. So the main narrative thrust of this issue is to get those two characters back onto the board for the final two issues of this event. So I enjoy the opening sequence. I'm a sucker for this kind of thing where we have two stories being kind of told in parallel. We're inside the minds of both Logan and Creed. Logan dozing in his hospital bed and maybe having some Kid Omega influence on him because there's pink glow kind of here and there. And Creed inside that Venus flytrap. With Logan's panels and narration down the left sides of pages, Creed's panels and narrations on the right. I'm a sucker for that kind of using the former comic books in a clever way kind of thing. No particularly deep insight into these two characters, but it does lay out the contrast between them pretty nicely. Did you get a kick out of this bit as well, as I have a little bit of tea?
I thought it was all right. I think I mentioned the last time we talked about Wolverine that I'm kind of beyond interested in this story. Sort of like gone on too long, and so it just felt in my mind more like a filler story than anything else. But for what it was, it didn't offend me. Like I saw two different voices.
Put that in the trade paragraph, trade paperback. It didn't offend me, Ruben from Weird Science.
Yeah, well, cutting to the end just quickly when I think I jokingly said, you know, oh yeah, Venus flytrap. Well, Sabretooth will just punch his way out of it, right? And that's kind of exactly what happens. Yeah, and I was just rolled my eyes. I was like, seriously, guys? Like,
well, I'm hoping we don't actually see the full Sabretooth. We just see his hand emerge, kind of like Terminator 2 ending, but in reverse, you know, comes up instead of down. So I'm hoping that he's somehow transformed by the experience, right? We don't know what the seed really does. I'm hoping it's more than just a Venus flytrap that holds him in for, you know, 73 minutes or whatever it was. So maybe Sabretooth is actually different because of the experience, whether, you know, one way or the other. And that's what I'm holding out hope for.
I would applaud Ben Percy if that is the outcome. He's a changed man.
It would be interesting. But, you know, the narration we're getting on these opening pages from him inside the Venus flytrap is not really signaling that he's changing.
No.
It isn't. But again, I still have some hope. If it's just, oh, I was stuck for an hour, now I'm back out, and I'm still just as angry as I was before, I'll be disappointed. But it seems that's probably the most likely outcome.
Mm-hmm.
So after that opening, we got three story strands going on. We have Laura and the various Orcus and Sabretooth types above Krakoa on Orcus Station number 5. We have Wolverine and the Exiles going after a certain item that Logan requires, and then we have one brief scene back at the greenhouse, a.k.a. Krakoa further north. So, starting off with Laura. As folks probably remember, last time out, Laura broke out of her orca cell, killed a few mindless one Sabretooth, and then ripped Shebertooth completely in half. Now she's being confronted by Graydon Creed, who wants to go by Bad Seed. Is accompanied by Camo Sabretooth and a whole horde of mindless Sabretooth. Laura escapes by jumping out a door, you know, a million feet up in the air. And on the way out, she announces that, oh, I've disabled the station's cloaking device, and now the Stark Sentinels are going to be attacking you, so deal with that, suckers. How do we think she disabled the cloak? Was it when she threw that Shebertooth heart at a panel and it exploded last issue? Can we make that, oh, she happened to hit, or she recognized she was destroying the cloaking device at that part? That could be kind of clever. But yeah, I would have liked to see something more, oh, here's where I'm disabling the cloaking device, rather than just saying it. I did think it was funny that Laura did not happen to bring a parachute along, but she just jumps out of this carrier and plummets straight down like she's in Looney Tunes and creates a crater there on Krakoa. Pretty funny. She has a healing factor, so she'll be okay. But you know, I did want to see her hold up a little sign like Wile E. Coyote on the way down. Meanwhile, Graydon, or Bad Seed, he uses his extra-dimensional tech to take control of one of the Stark Sentinels and pilot from the inside like he's on Neon Genesis Evangelion or something. He uses that Stark Sentinel to beat the stuffing out of all the other Stark Sentinels. Now, we have seen Stark Sentinels get taken down a whole lot of ways over the past year or so. I kind of wish we had made a list of it in retrospect, because that could have been fun. But this was one of the more creative ways to do it, I thought. And, you know, he's got this, quote, extra-dimensional tech, whatever that means, so I'm fine with him having no problem taking it over. They said some magic words and looked pretty cool. So, yeah, I thought this was an all right, if not particularly inspired, Sentinel-on-Sentinel battle. What did you think of that fight?
It was a cool fight, but again, I was annoyed by the wildly, you know, divergent threat level of these things. You know, at some
extra
levels,
dimensional tech, Ruben. Extra yeah. dimensional. It's got a okay. whole new dimension to it.
Yes. It's just, I don't know. I accept that it allows you to, I guess, co-opt and pilot one from the inside, but it seems like sometimes these things are unstoppable and other times you can jump out of a plane and defeat an entire group of them.
Yeah, and he did look a bit like Omega Red with these kind of cables coming out of him and attaching. So, you know, it's not super brilliantly original, but I thought it was at least something. We need a couple of fight scenes in a Wolverine issue, and this gave us one of them. So moving on to Wolverine himself, he's more or less recovered from his injuries, which is kind of quick given just how badly he was beaten and stabbed and, you know, that he doesn't have any healing factor at all anymore. His name's on the cover, so he's going to be okay. Some pretty heavy narration here that I didn't need so much of. The idea is that old Logan realizes, now I can die just like the rest of you meatbags. I'm not going to recover from everything. I get what the writers are going for, kind of a bit much. The Exiles and their ship take Wolverine up off the coast of Alaska, because he wants to get something there. Third Eye uses his magic senses to learn that Graydon Creed, Bad Seed, is back from that other dimension, so now Wolverine is up to speed on that development. The team has this weird fight against some grizzly bears. Again, for no apparent reason other than, hey, Wolverine has to beat somebody up in a Wolverine issue, so let's give him some bears to fight.
Yeah.
It made me feel bad for the bears. They were just kind of hanging out, being bears, and suddenly they're in this fight with mutants.
Yeah, and I have a feeling they're probably an endangered species at this point with global warming and all that.
Well, they sure as hell now. They got the bears have Achilles tendons? I don't know. They got whatever the bear equivalent is of tendons in their feet and ankles kind of messed up. But
yeah,
poor guys.
Yeah, they're like, don't kill them. Just maim them in a way that ensures that they will not be able to hunt seals.
Yeah, and these bears just attack. Like, our heroes are pretty fair distance away, come over a hillside, and the bears just charge at them. And I'm no bear expert. I wouldn't expect bears to do that. I would expect they're already eating fish, so I would have thought they'd be left on their own. I guess you could have come up with some excuse for, oh, why these bears were exposed to something, or there's some bad guys who made them attack, but we just needed a fight.
That's a good point. Yeah, they have food already. Why would they care?
We needed a fight. We need to have Wolverine show that he was still willing to fight, even though he's vulnerable, I guess, is the change here, but kind of unnecessary. So they wander off after beating up these poor bears. They find a door marked with an X, and behind that door is a set of very, very shiny adamantium armor that Logan had Forge make for him all those months or years ago. And also one of those two Muramasa blades that played a part in the whole X of Tens thing.
Yeah.
Which I thought aesthetically, the Asian-style blade kind of clashed with the more European plate mail-style armor. But it still looks pretty cool. That's a nitpick. It Wolverine in armor. You know, just say out loud, hey, put Wolverine in armor, and people are going to say, yeah, that's cool.
I think you have to be careful with this, too. You don't want cultural misappropriation if Wolverine was in a Japanese-style outfit.
I mean, he's always wearing Japanese-style stuff, right? He wears kimonos. He uses Japanese swords. I think that ship has sailed. I think, you know, you're either mad at that already or you've kind of accepted. I do like that the helmet even has the really big pointy ear things to match Logan's classic mask. That's kind of fun. How about the other guy in this event, the one whose name is in the title of the event? Let's check in on him. And for Sabretooth, first we need to check in with the rest of X-Force back at the greenhouse, a.k.a. Krakoa further north. They had received Laura's SOS message from Orca Station 5, but they ain't got no Bluebird to go after her and help her because Wolverine took the Bluebird at the end of issue 44, and he got it all blowed up on Krakoa by Stark Sentinels in issue 45. I'm sure you remember that great, ridiculous panel of Logan jumping out of the Bluebird as it exploded? Remember that?
Yeah.
That was good stuff. So Black Tom builds them transportation by commanding Krakoan vines and such to form into a ship, which I think is supposed to use up all the Krakoan power at this location, kind of the same way Mr. Sinister used up all the Krakoan power in the White Hot Room to send those X-Men back to the real world. So I think this is them kind of wrapping up that location, kind of depowering the greenhouse. The ship itself, it's like vaguely Bluebird shaped, but I wouldn't ride that. It doesn't look very airworthy to me. looks unimpressive, not so airworthy is what I'm saying here. Now, before X-Force can head out, Phoebe Cuckoo, she gets another psychic phone call from that head of Quentin Quire, who had stayed behind in Forge's lab to keep an eye on Sabretooth, and he tells her Creed is just about to burst out, and that's where we see this kind of hand burst forth from the cocoon. So yeah, next issue, we should expect that Sabretooth is back on the board as well. So what do we think of this? It was all right. I am still kind of disappointed that the killing seed Doug gave the Exiles turned out to be not as impressive as we'd hoped. Again, I'm still hoping that Creed is changed somehow when he comes out. If he is, I'll be happy and pleased and say, okay, you did something. If he's not, and he probably won't be, it'll be disappointing. Logan's new armor looks silly in kind of a fun way. I'm good for that. I was okay with Graydon. I mean, bad seed taking control of that Stark Sentinel. Okay thing to do. The art was pretty good. I mean, we're going to be looking at some more Stark Sentinel fights today, illustrated by Kreese Lee, who is just so amazing at it that it's almost not fair to compare anybody else to it. But this art wasn't, to me, quite at that level, but did a perfectly good job of telling the story, and the drawing of the armor was cool. Got to give him that. So nothing profound here, but to me it was a perfectly okay issue of an action comic, so I'm giving it a 7 out of 10. Ruben, I'm thinking you're probably a little tougher on this issue than I was.
Nah, I'm fine with it saying it's a 7. I'm sure if you're into this story more than I am, you probably think it's great. And like I said, it didn't offend me. I just kind of didn't think much of it. I did laugh at how ineffective the Venus Flytrap was. It was like half an issue, detained him briefly inconvenienced him.
I do wonder what if there was an original plan for what the seed was going to be, because this was created by Victor Laval, and that was when he was telling that story that had more of the, you know, the social commentary, the historical awareness. So I'm going to guess that he had some more profound idea, but everything has to be wrapped up in this two-writer, you know, not miniseries, but 10-issue event. So it probably got nerfed along the way.
Yeah, that's my sense, is that they basically just were like, we can't have this thing hanging out and about
leading into the next storyline. So
right.
Wrap it
up. Still burning a hole in Necro's pocket. She's got to do something with it.
Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, the Krakoan text on the coming attractions page reads Berserker. So that's what we're hinted is coming next. And it's probably going to be some big, you know, big old knockdown, dropout fight. I think I said that backwards, but a big old fight between Wolverine and Sabretooth with the armor and the sword and cool stuff. And I still do think Wolverine has his healing factor back in the current continuity of, you know, the fall of the House of X stuff. So we'll have to see that return to him at some point, probably in issue 10, I'm guessing. Okay, moving on to our next title, which is Invincible Iron Man number 18, If I Only Had a Heart. Written by Jerry Duggan, art by the aforementioned Kreese Lee. He's usually credited as penciler when he's been in this issue. Here it just says artist. It does say that the inker is Walden Wong, so I'm wondering if there was just a mistake. It's supposed to be pencils and then inks. Inks by Walden Wong. Colors by Brian Valenza. Letters by Joe Caramagna. And hey, we start off with a brief scene with Rhodey in it. I haven't seen him in a while.
Yes.
Not since issue 12, which is when Tony sent that special not-quite-Saint-Christopher medallion to him. So he's still in jail, because Orcus made it look like he murdered a dude. Or Phalon did, at least. And for whatever reason, Orcus has chosen right now to try to murder him in his cell. Send just basic Orcus goons at him with, you know, basic guns. It's not going to work. He triggers a medallion, which obviously was an old war machine armor shrunk by Pym particles, and he uses it to bust out of the cell and kick the Orcus dude's asses. He also then strips all the clothing off the corrupt warden.
I know, and I
very
saw that, I was
strange
like,
choice.
I was like, what is going on here? And the series got very dark all of a sudden.
He's pulling the guy up kind of like by where his lapels would be if the shirt had lapels, and it rips, but then somehow he ends up with the guy's pants in his hands. How does that happen? Is this like, it looks like a shirt and pants, but really it's a onesie coverall situation? I don't get it. Jerry Duggan's sense of humor is going to come up a few times this week, and it's not working for me. It's creepy.
Yes.
Rhodey then, he's wearing the armor at this point. He steals a police car, and he has Sandman and Living Laser in the car, and they fly off to do whatever the hell they're going to do next. My notes say, in brackets, pause here for Ruben to complain about Sandman continuity issues. So go ahead, Ruben.
You're calling me out.
We're both kind of predictable, I think it's fair to say.
Okay, well, I didn't like it.
The Sandman
I'll keep it short. Yeah, I was like, where is he, right? We've seen him in jail, out of jail. Are there multiple Sandmans? Maybe that's what's going on.
Which is the other title he's having his multiple personality situation going on in? I forget.
Yeah, I don't recall either. I just remember seeing him out of jail and wondering, was he guarding Rhodey or not? The other thing I want to know is, where did this beer come from that Living Laser has in his hand? Was that in the police car, or was there a bar in the jail?
That's a good question, because we do see the trail from the armor going just directly from the prison. So they must have, it could be a soft drink. We don't. It's a green glass bottle.
It looks like a Heineken.
It does look like a Heineken or a, you know, a Stella Artois if you're classy. Years ago, this is a very much an aside, but I was getting into like fancy kinds of craft beer, and I told some people, oh, I'm really getting into Belgian beer, enjoying Belgian-style beer. So for a present, they got me a six-pack of Stella, which is technically
like
from Belgium,
yeah,
but is like, it's like Budweiser, but more expensive.
Yes, yes.
But it is technically Belgian. Okay, back
I'm
from
not
beer
too
world.
Good for that. I want to say, here's the other thing. I'm
yes,
looking at this. To the populace, this guy was put away for murder, right?
Right.
And even if Orcus falls, like, he's now an escaped fugitive prisoner. Like, and there's just some sort of joke about how She-Hulk has some more paperwork to do. I don't know what paperwork you file to get somebody pardoned for a prison break,
yeah,
but she's a damn good attorney.
Some sort of hand-waving, set the status quo back to, you know, where it came from. Orcus, oh, it was an Orcus thing, it doesn't count. We found they were corrupt, pardon, something like that's going to happen, I bet. But
yes.
For right now, he did also actually steal a cop car.
Yes.
So that's not great.
Roll my eyes.
I was like, this, I don't know how this is improving anything.
I guess art-wise, it was either have him steal a cop car or have Living Laser and Sandman both ride his back like he's a horsey, which would have looked even more ridiculous on panel.
Yes.
That's where our roadie's out. So now to the outback with Tony. So Tony's fight with Fei Long is over. Fei Long's defeated, but the Sentinel Buster armor is busted. Its power supply is smashed because Tony put the power supply behind like a thin sheet of plastic right in his chest with a big light around it. So That's where Fei Long, you know, smashed through it. Not a great design. And furthermore, the Orcus AI's plans are public now. So Fei Long knows he's been retired here. He's decided to team up with Tony Stark and kind of fight against his old partners. But more Stark Sentinels are on their way, and with the Stark Buster busted, Tony and Fei Long need help. And this is where Magneto got sent in by Emma to help out. The rest of this issue is really just an extended fight scene. Magneto uses his Master of Magnetism powers to power up the Sentinel Buster armor again. I don't really know that that works. Is he using a magnetism to spin a piece of metal around inside a coil of wire? It's very hand-wavy. I guess we just got to go with it.
Or he's just animating it and it's not actually power. But I don't know why it would be glowing behind him.
Yeah, it wouldn't be shooting out the blasts from the hands and stuff. It was just being manipulated like a puppet.
Yeah, weird.
But here we go. He's Magneto. He's an Omega. We just got to go with it. So they go from place to place, busted up Stark Sentinels and Orcus facilities with little to no difficulty. Very much like that first issue of the Avengers crossover. And then Nimrod shows up, and he's a little tougher. We get reminded, once again, that Nimrod exists in multiple robot bodies simultaneously, so he can be doing other things and the other titles at the same time as this is happening. Nimrod busts up the Sentinel Buster armor, again, now to little pieces, and Magneto busts it up even more by wrapping it around Nimrod. There's another really weird bit where Nimrod shoots Terrigen Mist at Magneto, and Tony has to save Mags by using the power of cold temperatures to condense the Terrigen Mist into a Terrigen puddle.
Yeah, we also have Magneto coughing on panel. Like, it didn't look like he really got this stuff out of the way before it affected him.
Yeah, I don't know how quickly Terrigen Mist is supposed to work, but yeah, Magneto recently back from the dead, and I don't know, kind of his youngest, sexiest self, but he definitely got a face full of this green gas. And I don't think we're going to see any repercussions from this. It seemed to be just like, oh, we need to fill up an action page and give Tony something to do because Magneto's doing most of the work in this issue. So Tony's got to save him at some point. And yeah, I don't know. Are they just going to leave the Terrigen there on the ground and hope nobody has any trouble with it? At this point, Magneto and Stark then kind of make a superhero circuit. Well, the book doesn't use that term. Magneto shoots a Mysterium spear through Nimrod, and Tony channels a bunch of, quote, pure energy through it to zap Nimrod. Nimrod's still mostly okay, unfortunately. Magneto finishes him off, or finishes this version of Nimrod off, by shooting all these multiple strands of Mysterium through Nimrod's body and twisting them all around, which I thought this bit looked kind of cool and creepy and like disturbing in a pretty well-drawn kind of way. What did you think of this defeat of this version of Nimrod?
It was all right. I bought it. Drink faster.
I need to drink my tea faster if you're going to have such short opinions. Okay.
It's all right. Just wrap some metal around him. I mean, we've seen him wrapped up in amber. That seemed to stop him as well. So Mysterium, which is more indestructible, would buy.
That brings up a question. That he was all wrapped up in amber, and that was a big thing. He was wrapped up in amber, so he was off the board for a while. But what about all the other Nimrods who were in other robot bodies at the same time? It shouldn't have mattered at all that one of them was trapped in amber. Oh, well. No one brought that up at the time.
Yeah.
So at the end of the issue, when Nimrod's been beaten up, Tony sucker punches Fei Long right in his face because, oh, he remembers that Fei Long did all those awful things like murdering his friend in the first 17 issues of the series.
Yeah.
This was a pretty okay issue. Fairly shallow, not a lot going on other than fighty stuff. It felt like this series had to go really fast for a couple months to get caught up to Fall of X. We're getting issues pretty frequently. And now it kind of feels like they're stretching a bit.
I agree. So I also think I'm ready for this series to be more than just a tie-in to the X-Men series, right?
I was thinking about
like
that, yeah.
Just kind of an unnecessary like side story. And this character deserves his own kind of agenda.
I do wonder what this book is going to be like, because, well, next issue teases a fight between Tony and Rhodey, which feels like a misdirect, because why are they fighting each other? That issue doesn't come out until June 19th, which is a couple weeks after the Krakoan era is all, you know, finished and put away. So, actually, I don't even know, Ruben, if you and I will be reviewing this book by the next issue, because it won't be X-Men related anymore. Maybe we'll hand it back over to Jim. Be their problem. Haha. But yeah, it was okay book. I really do like the Creasley art here. It was a guest artist last issue. I like to see Creasley back. Just the way he draws the technology stuff is top notch. Really, really the best, I think, of any of the current Marvel artists. Fun to look at, even if the story had some strange bits like torn off clothing and Terrigen mist that comes and goes for no real reason.
Yeah.
Yeah, 6.5 out of 10. It was all right.
My headcanon retcon is that he thought he had Terrigen Mist, but it was just something else.
Fart gas,
yeah.
That's what it was.
Because it has, like, no effect on Magneto. I mean, that would fit
Nimrod's sense of humor we've been seeing, right? Just shooting fart gas at Magneto? So what number you want to put on this classic issue?
I'll just give another 7. It didn't offend me. It just made me kind of laugh at some of the stupidity. And it's all right. It was nice, at least, to see that Rhodey was not forgotten. I appreciated that.
That is great. We didn't have to put his story aside for kind of a long time to get all the X stuff handled, but it'll be good to see Rhodey back. Though the teasing that they're going to be fighting against Tony, it does seem like a classic Marvel misdirect, and we'll see what really happens.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm going to talk about it, but I don't believe that cover at all. That cover is not real.
Speaking of covers that have some maybe not so real things on them, let's talk about X-Men number 34, Love Hate, also written by Jerry Duggan. Art by Joshua Cassara, colors by Romulo Fajardo Jr., letters by Clayton Cowles, and design by Tom Muller and Jay Bowen. So on the cover here, it's a very classic, this is my last issue kind of cover, because we have all the characters facing forward mostly, lined up and posing, looking like badasses. Even characters who really aren't around anymore, like we see the Talon, the older version of Laura. She's there with Sync, although she's dead. We see Scott and Jean gazing into each other's eyes or masks like they're a happy couple, which they very much are not. But this is supposed to be clearly, hey, Jerry Duggan kind of saying goodbye to his time on this title. And I'm okay with this as a cover. Oh, it also has Krakoa in the background with Doug in his tree limbs. And that's not
Forge in the
right
Caliban
now.
Outfit.
Forge of the Caliban. That's a good call. Forge of the Caliban outfit, yeah. They destroyed that outfit, didn't they? Wasn't that part of the deal? He realized he was doing something kind of icky.
Yeah, I look at this cover and I say, like, this looks like this was an important time, right? Like, the way this looks, I'm like, oh, I remember kind of like all the stories they were supposed to tell or, like, sort of told.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in this little stretch
Kitty
of time.
In a Shadow Cat outfit, all that
good
stuff.
Yeah, and it wasn't handled very well. Red Root, I see Red Root on Apocalypse's shoulder. Yeah,
it's a cool cover, yeah. But it does kind of, it looks like it's definitely trying to say, hey, this was an important time and actually remember all this cool stuff. And some of it, yeah. And some of it you go, oh, maybe there was some potential there that was maybe not entirely taken advantage of.
That's exactly how I look at that. I say it's just like lost potential. Like so, this stuff could have been cool. It just ultimately wasn't, in my mind, as cool.
Some of it was. It was up and down. There were some issues where it felt like it was treading water, and there was a few where going, oh, Jerry Duggan's kind of latched onto something here. I'm thinking at the end, it almost seems like the other books in this event, the Fall of the House of X stuff, got so much of the important things happening that maybe there wasn't that much left for the title, the X-Men title itself to do. Maybe that was part of the problem. So, moving inside past the cover, this issue of X-Men, which is the last before the big number 700 wrap-up, answers a burning question that's been on every X-Fan's mind since Fall of the House of X number 2. Namely, hey, whatever happened to that MODOK fella? Everyone's wondering about that, right? We all say, oh, where's MODOK? When MODOK's not around, we want to say, oh, what's MODOK up to? This issue is a mess for me. Humor that doesn't land. Painful dialogue. And some attempts at concluding emotional arcs that, I mean, were better than the humor and the dialogue, at least. I'll give it that much.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not naming names, but there's another comic book weekly podcast, one I listened to before I ever knew about Weird Science. And that podcast named this issue their Book of the Week.
Wow.
Not their X book of the week, not their Marvel book of the week, but across all of comics, this was their book of the week. And no, I know tastes differ. People can like things I don't like. That's fine. But I don't get that.
Yeah.
So let's at least go through the major events of this issue. MODOK lands on a tugboat in New York Harbor, which makes me ask, is this the same Orcus tugboat where Firestar was held captive?
Yes.
You think so? Or maybe Orcus has multiple New York tugboats. Maybe it's the same one.
That's part of their agenda.
Maybe that's somebody on board there owns a tugboat factory, and this was their way of getting a little extra money by making Orcus buy tugboats.
That's hilarious. Yeah, that's probably what it is. It's just
a little feather betting, whatever the term is. So MODOK triggers something on his glove that starts turning every Orcus goon into a hideous, bulging tentacle monster. Which I guess is supposed to be a feature planted by the Orcus AIs that MODOK found out about and is now exploiting.
Mm-hmm.
More than a little reminiscent of what Orcus did by tainting the magic mutant meds. But again, completely without any setup or foreshadowing. It's just, oh, we need to have MODOK do a thing. He can do this thing. Which really just gives the X-Men somebody to fight other than MODOK himself. That's really the only reason this seems to be happening. So, yep, the mutants do that. All these Orcus goons, I guess, across the city, across the world, unclear. They all turn into these monsters, and the mutants just murder them all to death brutally. After that, it's time to fight MODOK. And I don't know about you, Ruben, but I would have been perfectly fine with MODOK just peacing out there in Fall of the House of X and not coming back for a while. Yeah. I did not need to see an end to his story. He was fine just leaving.
Yeah.
But he's back. And Kamala, Ms. Marvel, she has this handheld device she uses to track MODOK back to the tugboat. I looked through this issue a few times. I have no idea where that device came from. They just have these, I'd say, like Radio Shack MODOK trackers. I don't know. It just appeared in her hand. If I'm missing something, listeners, if there's, hey, dummy, it was right there on page this, panel that, let me know. I couldn't find it.
Yeah.
And at that point, Kamala, Firestar, Talon, and Sync, well, they take down MODOK with essentially zero problems. It ends with Sync and Talon doing a fastball special, and then we see Kamala giving MODOK cute little karate chops.
Yeah.
It isn't even me saying cute. That's the word Talon uses to describe Ms. Marvel. Oh, she's so cute.
Yeah.
So, Ruben, tell me this. After this panel, the karate chop panel, what happens to MODOK? Is he taken to custody? Is he murdered like everybody else in the Orcus? What, does he get away?
I don't know. He just
disappears from the book.
Yeah.
this whole issue is about fighting MODOK, and we don't know what happens to him because now it doesn't matter. Now Jerry Duggan stopped caring about him, so he just stopped existing.
Yeah, I guess so. He's there. He gets hit. They turn around, and now they're fighting mutants on the dock. And then they look at the city and share some kind of like weird romance thing and then just fly off.
That's it.
Yeah.
And I guess can't
they just left him on the ground.
Maybe there'll be a whole little short story about MODOK in the issue 700 coming up.
Yeah.
Kind of doubt it. But other than that, I don't know what this was.
Looks like they just left. They left Firestar and Ms. Marvel to deal with it. They're like, they can deal with it. They can handle it.
I do want to give some dialogue samples just to get a flavor of this. I'm not going to use MODOK dialogue because he's supposed to be over the top, right? He says ridiculous things. Completely in character. These are all from Firestar, who's a much more grounded, realistic, you know, conflicted human being kind of a character. Tell me if you think these quotes sound like classic Firestar. You ready? Here's number one. I joined Orcus to pretend and kick ass, and I'm all out of pretending. Number two. I love the smell of napalmed MODOK in the morning. Classic Firestar. And number three.
I don't know what you're trying to say, man. This is, sounds exactly right.
It's right out of X-Men 97, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Number three, a machine designed only for killing doesn't deserve to live.
Yeah.
Which is like, it's an attempt at a parallelism, kind of a cool-ass saying, but just, it's one of those lines that you're like, oh, I'm going to come back and put this is the placeholder, right? Come back and put the good line in later, and he never got to it. So some bits are a little better than this. The attempt to conclude the Sync and Laura tragic romance arc by Sync and the new young Laura having a moment, that wasn't bad. That was okay.
It's kind of awkward in a way. It was kind of awkward in a way in my mind. It's like getting over his deceased wife by being interested in her younger version.
it wasn't like he was hitting on her. He was acknowledging that this is the person who I knew all those years, but also isn't.
Yeah.
And yeah, it is awkward because that's what this crazy universe is giving them.
Yeah, you know, no, I accept version. It. It's just, I was just going to like kind of cringe. I was getting some cringe feel.
Yeah, it had a moment where he acknowledges the important things that Laura did to save him and to save mutantkind in general or just humanity in general by the part she played in getting that device back from what's-his-name on Counter-Earth so that they could, you know, cure all the mutant meds problems.
Yeah.
And there's another set of scenes with Kitty that are pretty good. This is Duggan trying to deal with the whole transformation of Kitty from, you know, being her regular Kitty to being Kate Pryde, the pirate and marauders, to then after the gala being this violent ninja shadow cat version of herself.
Yeah.
So we're told that Emma has assigned Shadow Cat, I should call her Shadow Cat in this case, assigned her to find the trainer's Professor X and murder him to death, which seems like kind of a mismatch. I mean, she's badass, absolutely. No doubt. But her going up against Professor X? Yeah. I don't know about that.
Yeah, I don't think she has the capabilities.
And there's a bit where we think she's found the professor. The art does a pretty nice job here, showing this bald silhouette with ears. We're like, oh, she's got him. But the page turn reveals this to be Caliban, the mutant attendant mutant. Mutant detecting mutant. We learn, has been held captive by Orcus since the night of the gala. Again, feels pulled out of Jerry Duggan's rear end because this hasn't been set up at all. Mm-hmm. Did Orcus take him? I don't know when that would have happened. It feels kind of just out of nowhere, unfortunately. It's not a bad idea, but if he could have gone back in time a few issues and planted a seed for this, it would have been much better to me.
Yeah.
But it is kind of cool in that Kitty wants to use Caliban to track down Professor X and murder him. But Caliban's like, yeah, I'm not going to play along with that. I don't think you should be murdering Professor X, even though he is, you know, a real jerk.
Yeah.
And this is someone in the recent issues of X-Men in a Jerry Duggan book saying that murdering is wrong, which is very much a change and very much antithetical to where we've been. But it kind of feels like Jerry Duggan acknowledging that, yeah, this was a crazy time. Maybe went kind of overboard. How about a character like Caliban helping us dial things back? And I was okay with that.
Yeah.
So Kitty gets really mad at Caliban here because she's getting called out for being a murderer. And, you know, she doesn't want to really think about that. She has kind of a very short emotional breakdown. But Logan then appears. And the two have a fairly decent conversation about Kitty's reactions to everything that's happened since the gala. Kitty basically resigns from the X-Men here, right?
Yeah.
Is that how you took this?
Yeah. And now she's going to be a barista?
Yeah. She doesn't quite come out and say, Logan, I'm going to go make coffee now. But I mean, it is. I do like that this is an attempt to provide some continuity between this era and the next era. You kind of see her make a decision to go in a different direction. And she is going to be going in a different direction in the next era. So I like that attempt at connecting things.
Yeah.
On the final page, Logan literally takes up Kitty's sword. He doesn't have the Muramasa blade here, and he's not wearing the armor. So that's why I think he must have his healing factor back. He announces that he will be the one to hunt down and kill the traitorous Professor X. And Logan versus Professor X, that feels more reasonable, right? He's the best he is what he does, all that good stuff. So that'll be what Jerry Duggan's story in issue 700 is going to be, I presume. Well, actually, that probably happens in Fall of the House of X, don't you think?
Yeah, he needs to get a Magneto helmet pretty quickly, though.
That would be helpful going up against Professor X, sure. A couple interesting things in the art here on this last page. The scene takes place in a Japanese neighborhood of New York City, and there's a bunch of Japanese signs in the background. And I read some people who speak Japanese talking about this page, and they say that most of the Japanese signs don't actually say anything, like almost like random characters just to look cool. But one of them, the one all the way on the right, in kind of a pale purpley pink, does say arigato, which means thank you in Japanese. And one written in Krakoan characters also says thank you. Although it's kind of misspelled because it uses a separate T and H characters for the TH, when in Krakoan, TH is supposed to be one individual character. That's the last time I'm going to be able to nerd out about Krakoan alphabet, I think, but there you have it. But yeah, this is Jerry Duggan and Joshua Cassara saying goodbye to this book. This is their last issue as the main creative team. So it was kind of a neat way to sneak in, hey, thanks everybody, in the background. Kind of neat. So overall, we had a couple of okay emotional scenes, but the art for me is really the highlight of the book. Great action, cool poses. I really like the facial work in the Kitty Caliban scene. You could really see the turmoil and anger and, just not knowing what to do look on her face, and Caliban being this resolute, nope, I'm not going along with you, Kitty. Joshua Cassara really knocks out of the park there. But beyond those couple of scenes and the cool art, there's so much of the writing that was just, most of this book was a filler scene with MODOK that did not need to exist. And the dialogue that was used in that filler scene was just painful to read. So putting together the okay bits and the great art and the really awful parts, and I got to give X-Men 34 a 5 out of 10. Oh, not a special God. 5, plain, yeah. Ordinary, everyday kind of a 5. How about you, Ruben?
That's probably a fair score, but the art is so good. I have a hard time doing that. Yeah, it's beautiful art. So I'll just give it a 6. Not a good book, but honestly, you flip through it almost looks cool. Just like, oh yeah, some good stuff happened.
Yeah, the tentacle monsters are very generic, but he didn't really have a lot to work with. They're never going to be seen again. They came out of nowhere. They had to exist so that the X-Men could have somebody to fight. And they look cool enough for that purpose.
Yeah.
So that was X-Men number 34, the very last book of the series. And that's the last book we're going to talk about this week. Next week, well, I got to scroll all the way back up in my notes where I'm talking about next week. Oh, and I'm using a different computer this time, so I don't know where all the buttons are. But we have, oh no, Jim, edit this out because I don't know what I'm talking about. Next week, we have two, maybe three issues to talk about. We have Wolverine 49, which seems quick, but we delayed last issue by a week, and they're coming out every 2 weeks. So Wolverine number 49, part 9 of the Sabretooth War. I'm sure we're going to get to see Logan use that cool new armor. We get X-Men Forever number 3, which I'm really looking forward to. And also, Giant Size X-Men number 1 is coming out next week. No, not that Giant Size X-Men. This is a new one. Marvel's been celebrating the 50th anniversary of the original Giant Size by giving a whole bunch of different characters their own Giant Size titles, and this is the X-Men's turn. It's going to feature a new Anne Nesenti story starring Angel, and they'll also have a reprint of a team-up from 1980 between Angel and good old Ben Grimm the Thing. Now, Tom Brevoort in his blog says that the new story will feature a new villain that, quote, I wouldn't be surprised to see resurface in the near future. He wants to sell the book. Of course, he's going to say that. But I'm going to at least take a look at it, and we'll probably talk about it maybe in just the news section to see what's going on with good old Angel. That sound like fun, Ruben?
Yeah, sounds good.
Cool. So between now and when we get to read Anne Nesenti writing about Angel, what should our loyal listeners do to pass their time?
Yeah, read more X-Men comics.